songs about that time. Right about now.
Right about now. Right about now.
You often want a sentence to end with a bit of a bang, a strong noun, a strong something. And I have found that on occasion, if you simply flip a couple of the elements in a sentence around, you get to a good strong finish.
That is my guest today, Benjamin Dreyer, offering one of many tips about how to be a better, stronger, faster writer. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Write About Now. I'm your host, Jonathan Small. It is always a pleasure to have you along for the ride. So my guest today, Benjamin Dreyer, is the author of a New York Times best-selling book, a new book. This guy's got a hot book on the stands right now. Do people still buy books on the stands? Probably not. But anyway, his book is hot. It's hot. Red hot. It's called Dreyer's English, An Utterly Correct Guide to Clarity and Style. Benjamin Dreyer is the copy chief of Random House. That's a big job. All the books that come out of Random House, he's the copy chief. He's the guy they got to get through before they get out on those aforementioned stands. And Benjamin is sort of, I don't know, I would call him almost the guardian of the grammar galaxy, but he's not too precious about what he does. And I was just fascinated to have him on the show. I love like geeking out on grammar, even though I'm terrible at it in real life. Benjamin's going to walk us through just a bunch of ways to make your writing read a lot better on the page. He is a master. Some of the things we talk about, we go deep on this one, deep into the crates. We talk about words that he suggests that you just go a whole week without using in your writing. Some of them may even surprise you. We talk about, you know, those grammar rules that have sort of been drilled into your brain since elementary school. Well, a lot of those are BS. And Benjamin's going to shed some light on those. He's going to talk to us about his feelings on adverbs. A lot of people are very, very anti-adverb. Stephen King, for example. But where does Benjamin stand? All right, those mysteries and more coming up. Benjamin Dreyer, welcome to Write About Now. I love this book. Tell me a little bit about your origin story. Like, how did you fall into this profession? And you tell a very funny story in the book about you kind of when you were a kid going into a bake shop or something. Tell us.
The local bakery in the what we wouldn't have called a strip mall. It was in the little shopping center.
Right. And how old were you at this time?
Oh, I would have to be maybe 10 or 11 when I would be sent on my Schwinn to go pick up some things from my mom. And so it's this bakery and I'd go in to buy, you know, dinner rolls and a couple of black and whites. And there was a sign above the counter and it said, "Try our Rugelach. They're the best." And the word "best" was encased in quotation marks with an exclamation point, of course, following. And even then, as a prepubescent, pre-copy editor, I thought there's something about those quotation marks that isn't right.
Yes. And did it kind of rankle you a bit? Were you just like, ooh, that is just, that it makes me a little crazy?
I think I was mostly just intrigued. And clearly, I often think about the odd things that imprint themselves in the back of your head and you carry them around with you for decades before they're useful.
Yes.
Clearly there was something going on at that moment that was setting the stage for what was going to happen a very long time later.
But you didn't set out to be a copy chief and a copy editor, or did you? Did you sort of know right early on that you wanted to do that profession?
No, I didn't. I had always thought that when I grew up, I was going to be an actor, and that was something I had great passion for. So I went to Northwestern with the intention of becoming an actor and studying acting. And I found that I was in school with a lot of people who were, as far as I could tell, vastly more talented than I was. I mean, maybe if I'd had a little bit more gumption, I would have figured out what to do to stick with that. But essentially, I thought, you may not be any better than mediocre at this. And I couldn't settle for the notion at age 20 that I was going to grow up to be a mediocrity.
Yeah.
So I walked away from it and found that after I got out of college, I didn't have anything in particular that I wanted to do. So I just sort of wandered about for a few years, and I would I worked in restaurants because that was an easy way to make money, and I went to double features and revival houses, and time passes, and eventually I move back to New York, and I'm close to 30 years older. I am 30 years old, and it's time to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea what I want to do, but I have a friend who's a published writer, and I said to him, do you think there's something I might do in publishing? And that's how little I had no idea. And he said, well, you might be a good proofreader. He had, on occasion, he would show me the early galleys of his books, and I would read them, and it was always nice to have sort of a preview of something. And I might find something, a little glitch, something, you know, not necessarily just typos, but like, you know, the wrong word, or in any event, I would point it out to him nicely.
Yes.
And so he introduced me to his production editor at his publishing house, the production editor being the person who hires copy editors and proofreaders to get the book, you know, all the way to the finish line. And she hired me, hired me to do a job. She didn't give me a test. She simply said, I'm assuming that if you're a friend of your friends, because he doesn't tolerate people who are not, you know, smart. She said, I'm assuming that you're reasonably intelligent. And I was like, I'm going to say so. And she hired me. I lied in part. She asked me if I knew the proofreading symbols, and I didn't, but I could find them fast enough. But I started to do this work, and it turned out that I had a knack for it. And she was a wonderful mentor and teacher, and gave back very concrete, very specific feedback, which was invaluable. So she's hiring me to do this work, and I'm trying to learn everything that I can about all the things that I hadn't really learned in high school or in college about sentences and sentence structure. I mean, I knew the difference between a subject and a predicate, but it didn't go much further than that. So I'm proofreading, and eventually I'm educating myself by observing copy editing in the margins of these manuscripts that I'm reading against, and I sort of taught myself to copy edit.
But you had no formal training, but you just had an instinct about, were you one of these people that just always was very interested somehow in the rules of grammar? Because not everybody can sit down and do that.
No, I was simply always reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I had a good ear. And I think that a good ear is very important to a copy editor. But what also then becomes important is learning the names for the things that your ear is telling you.
Yeah.
You learn grammar. If you're me, you teach yourself grammar, and you don't need to sort of carry those terms around with you and throw them down in the margins as you're explaining things to writers. But it's nice to know what you're talking about.
So tell us the difference between what a proofreader does and then what eventually you would end up doing.
All right. Well, taking it, if I may, in the other direction, because it's the more logical way.
Okay.
Once a book has been edited by the person that I tend to refer to as the editor, the person who contracted the book for the house, quite possibly, and went through it draft after draft after draft with the author to work on all the things that editors work on, characterization and story arc and pace and the very big ticket stuff. And some editors do work down to the sort of nuclear level, sentence by sentence, but to some extent, they know that the copy editor will follow and let copy editors do what copy editors do. So what do copy editors do? A copy editor will go through a manuscript once it's been deemed to be finished, and you do the very mechanical things. You're, of course, trying to make sure that everything is spelled correctly. You're working on the punctuation, possibly in a sort of standardizing way, but to make things clear, to make things consistent. You then get to do sort of larger things. You might, for instance, well, you're certainly keeping an eye on logistics and chronology. If it's a novel, for instance, you have to make sure that the characters are aging at the same rate, that they're not changing hair color or eye color, unless that's part of the story.
Right.
you're also keeping an eye on an author's penchant for using certain words over and over. Every author has pet words. And once they use them, they'll keep using them. And you will point out to the author, you've used that phrase, you've used that adjective, you like that color a lot. And maybe the author's doing it on purpose, but it's your job to ask.
Yeah, so you ask. Because I was going to ask about that because, you know, obviously repetition is sort of the scourge of many copy editors. And even when I'm editing something and somebody keeps repeating a word, it just bugs me. But sometimes it's stylistically they're doing it that way. And how can you tell the difference between if somebody's doing it stylistically and if, you know, it's just they're screwing up?
You can't always be certain. What you can do is simply query the repetition at the author to find out, as the author reviews your copy editing, whether the author did do that thing on purpose.
Yeah.
One thing that authors occasionally do is they will write something that rhymes.
Uh-huh.
And they strike the copy editor as either inadvertent or maybe a little sort of graceless. So you might ask the author if the author had said something like, the day was green and she was feeling quite mean. Did you mean to do that? And
yeah,
the author may say, oh, no, I didn't, so I'm going to change that color. Or the author may simply say, well, I did or didn't do it on purpose, but I like the sound of it just fine.
Right.
You know, you're asking those questions. Sometimes I can tell quite simply,
yeah, it's just obvious.
You didn't mean to do that, did you?
Right. So just to go back, so you were proofreading. So tell me where that comes into the process.
Right, so the manuscript's been copy edited, the author's reviewed it, it's gone back, it's been cleaned up, you make sure all the questions are answered. And then the thing is typeset.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a set of designed pages is output that reflects all of the copy editing and is now set in a form that resembles the book as it's going to be published, you know, with typesetting.
Yeah.
And what the proofreader is then doing is simply, and I can pull out the air quotes for that, simply going through the typeset text to make sure that everything that went on in the copy editing has been properly brought over to the typeset pages, which was a little bit more complicated in the days when everything was being done by hand, because then you have a typesetter who's trying to read people's handwriting, and that can go a little off.
Yeah.
Now, of course, you just do that in track changes. The proofreader is also simply on the lookout for things that may have eluded everybody else to that point, and that can happen. You know, the author got something wrong and the copy editor didn't catch it because maybe the copy editor was distracted by something else for a second. So the proofreaders are really that last
excellent
to make sure that the book that's going to be published is as close to error-free as a thing can possibly be.
Yeah. I want to know a little bit about your process. It's obviously probably changed over time, right? I'm sure when you first started, you were doing everything by hand, right? And all the stets and the, you know, I mean, I learned that way too, with the underlining something three times for the caps and all these kinds of marks that I also had to teach myself because nobody teaches right. You how to do that stuff. Do you still do that? Do you still do it by hand?
I would say that about 90% of the copy editing that we now do departmentally is done via track changes.
Okay. What does that mean? Track changes? Is that
working in a Microsoft Word file?
Okay, got it.
The bubbles. And
like tracking a change, right? Okay.
Yeah. So everything is right there, and of course it makes the cleanup very simple because you're accepting things, and that's why there are so very few typos now in typeset pages or real typos, because everything is precisely as it is. The funny thing is that the one author I do now copy edit, and I haven't said her name. It's not that it's a state secret. I copy edit Elizabeth Strout, who's the author of, among other things, My Name is Lucy Barton. And I suppose she's most famous for being the author of Olive Kittredge, which predates our relationship. She likes to be copy edited on paper. So I copy edit her on paper because she asked, and that's a thing you do for a writer. So it's the copy editing relationship I have with her is rare, almost to the point of being unique, in that we're working on paper, which is not really done very much anymore, and B, we're an author copy editor team that, as I said, we sit in a room together and we review the copy edit. It's nice to put a pencil on a piece of paper.
Yeah. Now, one of the lessons I got early on when I was proofreading copy was to read out, to sort of read aloud the what I was reading, because there's something about when you read aloud, you catch things you might not normally catch when you're reading to yourself in your brain. Are your lips moving when you're copy editing? How do you approach it when you're looking at it?
They often are, and particularly if when I'm working on a manuscript and there's something about a sentence that's bothering me, mm-hmm. I'll read it aloud. And when I read it aloud, I can often quickly detect, oh, this is what's not working properly.
Yeah.
I think that text should be very readable, readable, aloudable. You should be able to say something and it should be very clear. And if something is muddled when you say it out loud, it's quite possible that it is also muddled on the page itself. Proofreading is mostly for me, when I occasionally am proofreading, somebody's asked me to look over something, is merely staring at the damn thing.
Let's talk about your book. I love your book. It's so interesting. And I love this kind of book. And was it weird being on the other side? You know, I was sort of like trying to think of an analogy. It's almost like if a director decided to be an actor, you know, suddenly you're writing, you know, for all these years you've been on the other side. How different was that experience as suddenly being a writer and not copy editing?
It was a trip. it was a trip, and it took me a long time to find my writer's voice. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, you know, I've been participating in the copy editorial process for years and before, and you know, of course, in college and somewhat, you know, beyond then, I had dabbled in a little bit of writing. So, you know, it wasn't as if it was an unfamiliar process to me. But to write this book was a grand undertaking, and it took me a couple of years working away at it and writing tens of thousands of words and throwing them out before I figured it out. Because what I was writing was either stodgy, it was too close to imitating other people's books. I think that I was trying to be very definitive, and I was trying to be exhaustive, and it was quite dull. It was deadly. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't figure it out. And eventually I did figure out that the voice I had cultivated by, you know, hanging out on Twitter, where one of my colleagues in one of our marketing geniuses once said to me in passing, she said, "Go on Twitter." And I said, "What for?" And she said, "Just listen to me." So there I am on Twitter, and I'm sort of playing the role of, you know, your friendly copy editor, uh-huh. and offering advice because that was what I was doing. And it took me a little while to realize that the voice I had cultivated at Twitter, trying to be funny, because I find being funny engaging.
Yeah.
And of course you have to be succinct, and you have to make your points. You have to go in, you have to go out, you have to be quite clear. I finally realized this is your voice.
Yeah.
Just get that onto the page and then just keep typing.
Yeah. That's really interesting.
And it was my Twitter voice that led to my book voice. Once that happened, I'm not going to say it was easy sailing from there to the finish line, because writing is a challenge, but at least I knew what it was supposed to sound like. And the nicest compliment I ever get, I think, from people who know me, who've read the book, when they'll say, "It sounds just like you." And it's like, good. It should sound just like me.
You know who I feel sorry for in all this is your copy editor. Like, that's a lot of pressure to copy edit like a master copy chief. Did you hand select this person, and how much copy editing went into the actual final, you know, manuscript?
I did hand select her. She was somebody who, when I was a production editor, when I was the person who was hiring copy editors and proofreaders to work on specific books, she was one of my favorite copy editors, because
okay.
she's so good, and she's such a good listener, and always found really good stuff. She was the one who, when you hired her to copy edit a thriller set in a small town in Washington, the manuscript would come back with a map.
Okay, it's very thorough.
If somebody's walking this way and going that way, that it works.
Yeah.
She was also a great favorite of editors and authors you know, once an author has worked with Bonnie, it's like, can I have Bonnie again? And so I asked the person in my department, the production editor was going to be handling my book, would you see if you can get her?
Yeah.
And she was pleased, and she made little sounds of concern. And I said, look, I said, I don't need to be petted and patted. It's the last thing I want. What I would like you to do is go in and like get your hands dirty and do stuff.
So she did do stuff. Like, she didn't just like leave it almost.
No.
Okay. That's interesting.
I mean, as I like to say, and I don't mean this to sound more flattering to me than to her. She did for me what I have always tried to do for other writers. Mm-hmm. She called out my bad habits, and she unknotted my very twisty sentences, and she pointed out my pet adjectives and my pet adverbs.
What were some of your pet adjectives?
My pet adjective, which I think proved to be in the book six times before she realized it was in the book six times, garden variety this, garden variety that.
Yeah.
Okay, once is
enough. It's enough.
There are there's ordinary and quotidian if you want to reach for that, but not six instances.
garden variety. You're a garden variety. Yeah, that's funny.
But she was sort of lovely and supportive. She made me feel safe. That's something you want to do for your writer. She would on occasion laugh at my jokes in the margin. That's always helpful. And one thing that she did that copy editors do try to do is to sort of participate in a kind of a ventriloquist act, where if she wanted to offer a piece of phrasing because I had already used this piece of phrasing or she thought something might be clearer, she could imitate me.
Oh.
And she would write out something, five words, six words, seven words, that I would look and go, oh, that sounds just like me. Good. I'm taking it.
Yeah, that's great.
Sticking it into the manuscript. Thank you for that. But she was wonderful, and she made it a better book.
Did they ever find any error, copy editing errors in the final manuscript that you know of?
Yes. Now it can be told, true confession, there were five typos in the finished book, little ones, and they've all been corrected. That's what reprint corrections are for.
Yes. Who found them? Like readers who were just, I'm sure, wanted to, I don't know, people, trolls.
Actually, it was a few of my colleagues who caught them all pretty quickly. And of course, other people have chosen to point them out. But most people tend to be very careful and respectful. And even when they know full well, this is not correct, they will ask in a way that's like, I just wanted to make sure you didn't do that on purpose. And it's like, that's the way to do that.
Yeah.
Because we're all doing it.
We're all trying our best.
And life goes on.
So let's talk about some of the specifics in the book. First of all, I just love your list. I have to reference it. This list of words that you should go a week without ever using at all and see what happens. This is how you open up your book. And just to read these out loud. So I've got very, yes, for sure, rather, really, quite, and in fact. In fact's a tough one because it always seems like you want to use in fact, but what's a different word to, what are different words to use for in fact?
I think the different words to use for in fact are not to use any words for.
So whenever in fact, you just don't use. Yeah.
It's like make your point and you're telling the truth and that's the in fact right there. What I do want to stress, and people tend sometimes to overlook, that what I'm saying is go a week.
Not forever. Yeah.
Just try it. Clean your act up a little bit.
Yeah. There are other words in here, and I totally agree with these. Just. The word so, which, you know, starting a sentence with so, yes. Oh, pretty. You don't like the word pretty, because pretty what does it mean? It's sort of a little, yeah. Okay. And of course.
Yes.
Of course is a good one. All right. So those are really, that I thought that was really interesting. I also was really interested in some of the rules. You know, I went to a school where we had a very kind of rigid English education. And we had this kind of legendary English teacher, at least in high school, named Mr. Nathan. And he used to be very much of a stickler so there was a lot of rules that were sort of ingrained in my brain. And some of them, you kind of, you say, you know, I'm not so sure. And one of them was to never begin a sentence with and or but. Talk to me about that. I mean, I know that the New York Times uses They always start with but. There's a lot of buts in New York Times.
Right. I mean, I so distinctly remember being taught not to do that. And if you, you know, if you did that, you were corrected. It was a mistake. It was not negotiable. In this instance, it's serving the thought correctly. It was like, no, this is wrong.
Yeah.
And you find when you read writers and when you read good writers that they will begin sentences with and or but, because sometimes it's the best way to begin a sentence. And sometimes that and sentence or that but sentence wants to stand on its own. It doesn't wish to be connected to the previous sentence with a comma. It wishes to be its own sentence. But I'm happy to say in the next breath, it's not always the best way to begin a sentence. And you shouldn't keep doing it over and over and over. At least think about what you're doing. You know, and that's really all I'm trying to do by deriding certain non-rules and by stating some of my very preferred preferences is to make you think about what you're doing. And certainly not to make you so self-conscious when you're in the process of writing that you become absolutely paralyzed. But, you know, do your writing and then go back and look at it and think about what you're doing. And if copy editing is, as it is to some extent, it's a great big bag full of tricks that I've accumulated over the years. One of the things that I'm trying to do in the book is simply to share those tricks with you.
Yeah, I love the tricks.
You can do them, you know, you can do them for yourself.
My last question about the rules, never end a sentence with a preposition. Another huge one that to this day, I still, when I end a sentence with a preposition, I'm like, oh, how do I got to fix that? I got to fix that.
You shouldn't be so rigid about it to the point where you're taking a sentence and you're twisting it in knots so as to make sure that it doesn't end with a preposition and you're filling it with, you know, to which I will not, you know, it's like, okay. You know, write in English. But again, there's the flip side of everything. You often want a sentence to end with a bit of a bang. A strong noun or a strong something. And I have found that on occasion, if you simply flip a couple of the elements in a sentence around, you get to a good strong finish.
Okay.
I equate it with something that, you know, writers of comedy know, that you can't put the laugh in the middle of the line, because if the laugh comes in the middle of the line, the audience isn't going to hear
the end of the
rest.
Yeah.
So you have to save the word that's going to make the audience laugh for the end of the sentence.
The passive voice is something that I feel every, you know, especially new writers, when I'm editing people who are not very experienced, it's there a lot. I find myself using it too. I mean, I'm not above the passive voice, but you have a rule of sort of, I think, sort of identifying if you're using the passive voice and how to fix it. And that's by adding by zombies.
And I certainly didn't invent that, and Lord knows. I mean, I think that copy editors and other sort of, you know, wordsmiths have been passing around that little joke for years. But essentially, if you want to know whether a sentence is written in the passive voice, it becomes whether or not you can add by zombies to the end of it. And for instance, the door was left open by zombies. It just means that the what would in a normal sentence be the front of the sentence, the thing that's acting, the sentence may not have an actor at all.
Yeah.
And the thing is, there is nothing wrong per se with the passive voice. And I'll tell you a truth, which was that in all the years that I had been copy editing, I had never really thought about the issue of the passive voice. It just, you know, it wasn't anything that like bled into my brain. Only as I was working on this and I was, you know, reading what other editors have to say about this, did I keep running into over and over and over again the question of, oh, the passive voice. So I deal with in the book, not with a massive amount of passion, because it's not something that's violently important to me, and it's not something that I'm on the lookout for all the time when I'm copy editing. But It's just another thing to pay attention to.
Yeah, no. And it's interesting that you say it's not a huge, you know, red flag for you, because I don't know if you know about some of these programs like Grammarly, which are these online programs that kind of do what you do, sort of, but, you know, which you can run your copy through. And I don't know what you think of them. It's a whole other conversation. But one of the things they always point out in Grammarly is passive voice. You should think of about a different way of saying this. Passive voice. They always flag that. What do you think of those programs? Do you find them useful?
Well, I'm quite a big fan of spell check.
Okay, I like that.
I always have spell check on when I'm typing, because I don't type any more neatly than anybody else does, and it catches me, which is a good thing. I occasionally do accidentally run into grammar softwares if I am working on somebody else's document, or just, you know, you run into them, and to which my response is often, "Oh, shut up!
Yeah,
I'll do what I'm doing. Thank you." I'm not so familiar with grammar softwares that I can say that they're helpful or not. If they're helpful to you, great. But I would say that in the same way that an author should be able to say, thank you, no, stet, to a copy editor, you should certainly be able to face down a piece of software and say, I appreciate the suggestion, but I wrote it the way I wanted to write it.
Yeah. Okay. Some other things I just want to, I've always had questions about, and I think a lot of people have questions about, which versus that. I think I was reading something that which frequently follows a comma. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay.
The Brits tend to use which for a lot of things. American style, not observed by everybody, but observed by me, because I like things to be neat. I like things to be tidy. I mean, for instance, just to digress for half a second, the idea that one uses the phrase each other to refer to a relationship between two things or two people, and one uses one another for three or more, that's not a universally observed rule, and it's not necessarily defensible in any particular way, but the way in which writers will simply often indiscriminately flip back and forth.
Yeah.
A little crazy. So it's like, let's do this way, and let's do that way, and it's just neat and tidy, and it's not going to make any difference to anybody except you and me, so let's just sort of do that. As far as the which that thing is concerned, yes, a phrase that is, let's see if I can phrase this properly.
I know, sometimes it's hard without writing it down. Right.
A piece of text that is necessary to the sentence, and that without which the sentence is not fully going to make sense,
mm-hmm.
should be attached to the body of the sentence with the word that.
Okay.
And will not be preceded by a comma, which is to say the sentence is incomplete unless that phrase follows. If you are offering a piece of information that is helpful or colorful or illustrates the point a little bit better, but that is not necessarily crucial to the existence of the sentence, it can be introduced by the word which, and it will be preceded by a comma.
Okay.
I guess that's the best way I can explain it in midair.
Sorry, just to go down my list of things that have always perplexed me, as well as versus and. So I never know when to use as well as, you know, like if you're doing a list and you're saying, oh, cookies, you know, peanuts, as well as, I don't know the difference. Like how would you define when you can use as well as?
I think that I would tend to use as well as to indicate something that is not part of the list proper, but is associated with it, is a slight exception to a rule. So you've got as well as, you know, not to mention. They're slightly digressive.
Right.
If it's just a string of things, all of which have equal weight, I'd probably just reach for an and.
Mm-hmm. I have to call out something that you wrote here, your nightmare sentence, which is, and then suddenly he began to cry.
Yeah.
Let's break that down. And yes, then some. Okay. Let's break this down. Why this is so horrible.
Any number of things you probably don't need. I think that the phrase and then, which many authors just keep using it over and over and over and over. It just, it's a weak transition. I was about to say, I don't mean to use the word cheap, but if I don't mean to use the word cheap, then why am I using the word cheap? It's a cheap transition. It's an easy way to get from one action to another. And it's a little dull. And after the fifth time, it's quite tedious. And then it's just mindlessly repetitive. And so when you have an and then, I find that more often than not, you could trim it to a then, and you'll be better off, or you can do without it altogether. Suddenly, I find, is also a somewhat rote way to drum up 2 seconds worth of excitement. Suddenly is another one that suddenly this, suddenly that, but particularly suddenly attached to something that isn't sudden at all.
Yeah.
I mean, gunshots are sudden and explosions are sudden. You know, suddenly she reached for a fork. It's like, you mean she reached for a fork?
Yeah.
She may have done it passionately. She may have done it vigorously, but suddenly it's just, nah.
Yeah.
You know, she began to do this. He began to do that. Otherwise known as he did that thing.
Yeah.
And then suddenly she began to cry, which you could boil down to she cried.
I was going
to
say.
She burst into tears is nice.
Yeah.
But, you know, always find a more interesting way to say the thing that you're saying. And I don't mean bedeck your prose with lots of sort of junky, flashy stuff, but be a little judicious.
Yeah. You know, you when you said she burst into tears, I thought to myself, is that a cliche? You know, we sort of think in cliches, we talk in cliches without even really knowing it. And when you write, you become very aware of all the cliches. A writing teacher once told me to sort of do a cliche pass on your copy. How do you think about cliches? I mean, I always say I avoid cliches like the plague, but what?
Yeah.
What, you know, what is your thought about cliches? And are you aware of cliches when you're copy editing?
You know, she burst into tears is perhaps not the most original piece of phrasing that anybody could ever come up with, but it describes an action and it mm-hmm. doesn't up off the page at me. It is really the more sort of, avoid cliches like the plague.
Yeah.
You know, it's that sort of thing.
Right.
Those very much just sort of trite pulled up from the well of cliche
yeah.
phrase that, if I can perhaps suggest that you might find another way to say something to freshen up that thought.
Right.
A little.
Just overused. They're just overused. Yeah. Cliches. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I am highly aware, particularly when I'm editing, when I'm reading fiction, I'm highly aware of the number of times that characters, stare off into the middle distance, and there's a lot of nodding and shrugging and, you know, contemplating with your hand on your chin and those sorts of things I will call out because they're dull.
Yeah. And it's hard. Sometimes it's hard to figure out different ways of saying things, especially if you're writing like a romance novel. You know, how many ways can you say certain things? I've talked to romance writers, you know, how much way can you say kiss passionately or, right. you know,
yes.
Speaking about kissing passionately, let's talk about adverbs for a minute, because I think, you know, Stephen King is sort of famous in his book for saying how much he has a distaste for adverbs and they should be shot. But you don't necessarily feel that way. In fact, the subtitle of your book is Utterly, right? Which is probably intentional. So tell me about your feeling about adverbs.
I love adverbs, and I use a lot of them. And I think that a interesting adverb adjective combo pack is just the thing that like will fill me full of joy, particularly if there's something sort of paradoxical about the combination. You know, delightfully painful. You know, mesmerizingly wretched.
Yeah.
If you can get two things like that to sit together and make a sort of a little bang, more power to you. I mean, I think that to have a grudge against adverbs is awfully close to having a grudge against adjectives. It's like, am I to write with one hand tied behind my back?
Mm-hmm.
And if so, why?
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't really make sense.
I love a good adverb.
You have a whole chapter where you call out words that are frequently misspelled, which is sort of insane because if you do have spell check, you should probably be able to spell words. But then I thought of the words that I always misspell and always have to look up. And there was one word that was not on your list. And I'm sure you tried to put every word that you could possibly think of. But the word jeopardy just kills me every time. I have to, I don't know why. It's a strange word that's spelled, and it's like, why is there an O there? And I hope we, and I don't know if it's P-R-D. I don't know. It's just, maybe I just have a mental block on jeopardy, just so you know, for your.
Well, that's a good one.
Yeah. Jeopardy. That's
a good one. I mean, you know, I mean, it's like the section on frequently misspelled words.
It's, yeah,
you know,
it's
what?
Arbitrary.
It was there. Yeah. It was there to amuse me.
Yeah, I loved it.
There, and I hope it amuses everybody else.
So, okay, the M dash. I don't know if we know the M dash is something that is very used. So, I as I mentioned, I edit a lot for magazines, and the M dash is like the sort of default. I don't know why, but magazine editors sort of hate commas, hate setting off clauses with commas, so they end up using a lot of M dashes. What's your feeling about the rule of the M dash? Like, what? Why would you use an M dash?
I mean, an M dash, or more often than not, a pair of M dashes, are, it's a wonderful way to make an interruption, something that is truly not part of the sentence proper. It is an interruption. It's something emphatic in the middle of a sentence. And it's very different to set something between two M dashes as it is to set something in parentheses. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a difference between an interruption and an aside.
Right.
A journalist friend of mine pointed out to me once that he had weaned himself from the habit of using parentheses because whenever he would include something in parentheses, his editor, working at a magazine where things were actually going to end up on the page, if the editor was looking to cut, because there was only so much space, it's like, well, whatever it is that's between those parentheses probably isn't necessary. So out it goes.
Yeah.
But I mean, commas are wonderful, and I mean, they're all wonderful.
Just use them. Know,
use them with a purpose. I'm as fond of M dashes as anybody.
You warn about the overuse of pronouns. Talk about that.
I do have a penchant as a copy editor to pull writers back from what I often think of as an overuse of pronouns. Mm-hmm. And I will often suggest putting a character's name back.
Yeah.
That unless the narration is very tight and it's, you know, and it's, and you can say he 50 times because we know who he is.
Yeah.
Say the name. And readers don't notice that as much as you might think. I think they unconsciously welcome the clarity of not having to figure out who a particular he or who a particular she is. And I do have a rule as a copy editor, which is that in any given paragraph, you should try to avoid applying the same pronoun to more than one person.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because it can readily become confusing.
That also makes me think of the whole argument, you know, about bringing they back, because the universal they instead of he or she, because that just drives us crazy. And you have a really interesting whole portion of your book where you're talking about how, you know, back in the old days, people could just say he. The pronoun, the sort of universal pronoun was he, which was obviously very sexist, and then it kind of, there was a movement to then there was he, she with a hyphen. And then people just started saying they, which I use sometimes in my writing. What is your feeling about using they to refer to a single person?
I mean, I think it's a generational thing. And as you go back and you read published writing from the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, you will rarely or to never see the use of the singular they, you know, in a sentence like, when raising a child, you should always be mindful of what they're doing. It's like, you just don't see that.
Yeah.
You know, you'll see a he or you'll see a she, or you will see what writers have, you know, have often done, which is to make sure that the subject of a sentence is plural so that the pronoun
that's what I usually do. Yeah.
Is they. And I will still, just because it's the way I have been trained, I will try to edit around that. I will try to figure out how to pluralize a noun if that works, or sometimes do a revision on a sentence so that there's no pronoun at all. And I tell myself I'm helping create a tighter sentence. There are people who will happily say, you're completely wasting your time. This is the thing, and it's a thing that I do say in the book. And I start with noting that the defense of the singular they is easy because you can point out that it's been used in written English for centuries. I will say yes, but, and the yes, but is the decades of the 20th century in which it was not used and in which we were taught not to use it. But now it's, you know, the singular they, as I say, it's not the wave of the future, it's the wave of the present. And we've had this conversation in my department. If we get a manuscript in which the author has quite clearly used the singular they, the copy editor knows not to do something about that. That's the way the book is written, and we respect that. It's not there to be corrected. It's there. It's the writer's choice. Which, and of course, all of this is a completely different subject than the subject of people whose personal pronoun is they. People who do not use the pronoun he, do not use the pronoun she. That's a different subject altogether. And the only thing I have to say about that is that one respects the choices of people as to how they choose to dub themselves.
And it's interesting how you came to that. Partly is because you started to work with somebody who didn't identify as either he or she. And so it became, it was really a real thing for you rather than just theory.
Yeah. And, you know, and as I said, it shouldn't have to take a personal interaction to get you to change your mind. Or excuse me, it shouldn't take a personal interaction to get you to think about something. But very often, that's just the way it goes.
Yeah.
We are affected by things that happen very close to us and people who are close to us. And it makes you think, I have to look at the world in a new way because I have a person standing in front of me. And I want to treat that person with respect and affection and love. And am I going to, you know, am I going to like tie myself in knots about a pronoun, or am I going to find a way to be human?
All right. Two last things that always bother me. Myriad. Yes. Myriad of or myriad. I mean, do you use it both ways? Because most people will say, for a myriad of reasons, you know. But wouldn't it be for myriad reasons? Isn't it?
You can use myriad as a noun, and you can use, so a myriad of blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
Or you can use myriad as an adjective. I have myriad troubles.
Okay.
Both are correct. I'm always very happy because people will occasionally, you know, violently demand that myriad be used only as an adjective because that's correct. And I'm always very happy to be able to point out that before myriad was ever used as an adjective, it was used as a noun.
Yes, so, thank you for freeing me from that. Yeah, because I've said myriad of my whole life. So it's been very, very hard for me. Another one is all right. The word all right, the proper spelling of all right is A-L-L, new word, R-I-G-H-T.
And I used to be very strict about that.
Uh-huh.
And again, you know, you reflect what you're taught. You do what you're taught. And if you're a copy editor, your brain probably leans a little bit on the conservative side anyway, because your job is theoretically correction and improvement. So you might be a little on the conservative side of thinking. I always found the construction all right, A-L-R-I-G-H-T, particularly when it was used in terms of whether something is correct or isn't correct, to be a little, I just found it really sort of sloppy looking.
It's like a lot. It's like a lot. It reminds me of the word a lot when people put the A, when they don't make the two different words.
Yes, which I swear I was taught in the fifth grade that if you have a lot of something, the teacher said it's spelled A-L-O-T and it's one word. And even then I was thinking, I don't think that's right. But as far as all right is concerned, if you're going to say that the kids are all right because you like the kids, even if the WHO decided that was spelled A-L-R-I-G-H-T, I prefer to see it as the A-L-L new word R-I-G-H-T version, which is the title of the movie with Annette Bening, two words, all right. But if you're going to peevishly say, all right, already, I'm coming.
Right.
That has nothing to do with correctness. And I can certainly.
That just has to be with being from Long Island.
Exactly. Where we say that sort of thing a lot. I recognize that A-L-R-I-G-H-T is, in fact, it's the way to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I can bend.
You're flexible. I like that. You aren't that rigid.
I am when I am and when it amuses me to be so.
Right.
And when it amuses me not, then.
Well, there are some words that you just can't make an exception for. And speaking of Long Island, the word that they used a lot back in those days was I'm so nauseous. Right. But that's incorrect. You can't say I'm so nauseous. It's I'm nauseated. I'm so nauseated. I think people should know this because it's.
I hope you and I are not about to have our first fight because we've been getting along. So.
Uh-oh. You can say not.
So I was one of those kids.
Okay.
Who, if I was gonna, if it's like throwing up was imminent.
Yeah.
I feel nauseous. And I don't think that I knew the word nauseated existed.
No, I didn't either.
Until I was in my late teens. I, of course, have had to do some research on that particular subject. And there is certainly a school of thought that says that the word nauseous should be applied to the things that cause or inspire nausea, horrible smells and things like that. And that nauseated is reserved for the act or the state of being about to hurl. And this is the thing about that slightly conservative mindset of doing things by the rules. If you observe that difference, nobody's going to yell at you. Mm-hmm. If you use the word nauseous to mean I'm about to hurl, somebody's eyebrow is going to go up a little bit. All I can say about that is I can defend the use of the word nauseous to describe I'm about to throw up through, many good uses over the centuries, predating the very rigid notion that this word meant this and that word meant that. You have to decide whether or not that's worth it to you.
Yeah.
To make use of a usage that is going to raise an eyebrow, that is going to earn you some pushback. And it's sometimes it's just not worth the trouble.
Right. It'd make you nauseous. Yeah.
I mean, the one that I like to cite is that again we're here we are on the East Coast in all of our sort of Jewish phraseologies. I'm a big fan of I could care less.
Yeah, I could care less. That's a good one.
Drive some people absolutely round the bed.
Yeah,
doesn't make any sense. It means the exact opposite of what you think it means. To which my response is, It's kind of sarcastic.
Okay? Yeah, I could care less.
You know what sarcasm is, and it's kind of Jewish, and it's like, do we have a problem with that? And the more people dig their heels in about it, the more I want to use it.
Yeah, I could care less is a good one. I didn't even know. I never even thought about it. It's one of those words you don't think about, phrases you don't think about, and it's.
Everything drives somebody crazy.
That's very, very funny. I love your rules. I just want to end with one rule. So you have these, you have the buy zombies is great. I never had heard that. Not rules. I mean, kind of tricks. I'm sorry. I love your tricks. Another trick that you had mentioned that I never thought about was for effect versus effect, right? So effect is a...
In most uses, effect with an A is the verb.
Is a verb.
Effect with... The two E's is the noun.
Okay.
And as I always say, I'm sure there's a mnemonic device about that, but the problem I have with mnemonic devices is I can't remember them.
Right.
There's some things you just have to learn.
Right.
And so effect with an A, that's the verb, and effect with the E, that's the noun. But, however, you effect change. If you are causing change to happen, you are effecting change, and that has an E up. And there's the noun version of it, not pronounced affect, but pronounced affect, which is the psychiatrist's term for the way in which a person presents
an affect,
their emotional mental state. And by the way, note that I said the way a person presents their, because whatever we think about writing and using they as a singular noun or their as a singular pronoun, Lord knows we all say it over
and
over.
That's the thing, right? That's a perfect example.
That's how you talk. But no, a patient has an affect. Traumatized patient has a different affect from a stable person. So affect is usually A for the verb, E for the noun, except when it's not.
Are there any other tricks, hidden tricks that you have used over the years that to help you understand whether one way is the right way to do it and one way is another? You know, I mean,
I was going to say the only thing that's popping into my head right now is not the trick to make something work, but the I say uncle, because people will say, is there an easy way to remember the difference between lie and lay and lane and laid? And the answer to that is no.
It turns out you just have to know what
you just have to, you just have to learn it. And it's like, you can find it in the book and you can put a sticky on it, because you're going to have to learn the grammar of it if you want to conquer it. It's just, there's no easy way out. You just have to memorize it. And you know what? It's like, we learn to spell in this highly irregular language that we speak and that we write. And as many people have said to me, thank God that, you know, thank God I didn't have to learn English as a second language, because it's impossible to learn as a first language.
Sure.
It's very tricky and it's weird and it's complicated and it's just this, it's this mess. You have to just, some things just have to be memorized.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Well, this has been so interesting, Benjamin. Thank you so much for doing the interview with me.
Well, thank you. And it was lovely to talk to you.
Everybody shut up.
Thank you for listening to Right About Now, hosted by my dad, Jonathan Small. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to his podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may find podcasts. Or you can go to his website, rightaboutnowmedia.com, and listen there. This is Ella, reminding you to do the right thing.